Hello everyone, it's Chris Hall here from Charity Digital, the organisation that helps other charities be more digital. Today, we have a special podcast for you. In March, we had over 400 charity professionals join us at Olympia London for a day of learning, knowledge sharing and connecting. We managed to record all of the 22 sessions from the day, and we'll be releasing them as bonus podcasts throughout the series to help share some of the amazing conversations we were having on the day. If you want to keep up to date with all our upcoming podcasts and events, like and subscribe the podcast through your usual podcast provider and sign up for Charity Digital updates at charitydigital.org.uk. Enjoy the pod. Everybody, welcome to our penultimate session of the day. I know, yes, sad faces all around, but there is some stuff worthwhile staying for, trust me. Up now, we have an amazing story, which at its heart shows you can really do anything with the right friends and mindset. Huddersfield-based Food Bank, the Welcome Centre and DataKind work together to implement a cutting-edge AI model to visitor data that's allowed them to deliver a user-centred service. Thanks to the partnership, the Welcome Centre has been able to design an early intervention programme that recognises the signs of dependency and lets them step in with the most appropriate advice, guidance and support before things start to spiral. We're really excited to have the Welcome Centre Treasurer and Trustee, Dr. Andrew Tomlinson, with us for this session. He'll be explaining how innovative analytics and machine learning has helped them get a clear picture on their users' needs and given them the confidence to grow and go forward on their own. So without further ado, please help me in welcoming Dr. Andrew Tomlinson.
So just before I start on this, I'm of an age that when I was at school, the first day back after the summer break, the teacher would ask you to kind of do an essay describing what you did on your holidays. Kind of Monday I went swimming, Tuesday I went to the park. This is a kind of case study, so it's almost a kind of what we did on our holidays type of presentation about how we used data science to implement a predictive model within the food bank where I'm a volunteer and a trustee. So who are we then? So the Welcome Centre, quite well known in Huddersfield and the surrounding area, but not well known outside of Yorkshire. But we are in fact one of the largest food banks in the north of England, and we've been going for quite a long time, over 20 years. And over the last 20 years since we were founded, our demand for our service has grown continually over that period. Perhaps initially it was as people were getting to know us, but over the last 5 to 7 years or so, the demand has really ramped up a lot more. And what we aim to do within the food bank is give practical help in the form of food packs mainly food packs, sometimes toiletry, sometimes household goods, to people who are experiencing a crisis in their lives. And although we're a food bank, and a lot of food banks operate just with volunteers, we actually have 6 paid staff and 100 volunteers who operate on a shift system around the week. And we actually have 2 sites. We used to operate from one place where we stored the food in the back and gave it out in the front office, but demand grew so much, so we now have a second site, which is our warehouse. And even our warehouse, we've had to expand to be twice the size it was when we originally took it on 4 years ago. And just to give you a scale of the kind of demand that we're seeing, our warehouse actually has a forklift truck to move the food around. And that kind of says something about the need for food banks, that you actually have to have a forklift truck to make it work. So that's who we are. And as I've basically said, food bank use is on the rise. I got involved in 2013, which was when there was the social care reform started, and they abolished emergency payments, and we saw a big rise in demand at that point. We've also seen more recently, as universal credit has started to be rolled out in Huddersfield and the surrounding area, we've also seen that as a big driver of demand as well. And if you can see on the graph, you notice there's a big kind of step up in the middle of 2018. That was when universal credit was started to be rolled out in the area. So food bank use is on the rise, and this is how we operate. So some food banks, and if you read the popular press, you imagine a food bank is something like a supermarket for the feckless, where you or someone could arrive, hand in a shopping list, and sometime later they get their food and they leave. But actually, the way we operate within Huddersfield, the way we've operated for our entire existence, is on a referral basis. So clients are referred to us, having been identified by another organisation, an external organisation, as being in need of help. So need has already been established by the time the client comes to the welcome centre. And our business process, if you want to call it that, is mapped out by this chart. So we have a couple of people who are on our telephones in the morning. So clients are referred by up to maybe 100 or 150 external organisations. We have a database that we record basic details on. From that, we work out what food packs are required for the client. We then create those food parcels, and then sometime later, the client comes to our premises to collect the food packs. So that was our business process up until 2017. Now, since I've been involved with the Welcome Centre, we've begun to use data more extensively within our organisation, both to understand demand and also to use it to drive our decision making. And this chart here really summarises quite well the kind of two extreme ends of demand in terms of a food bank. So you might be surprising for you to realise, but 43% of our clients, that's almost half of our clients, we will only ever see once potentially, certainly only ever see once within 12 months. So almost half our clients we only ever see once. But at the other end of the scale, we have a few clients, typically about 4% of our clients, who we'll see very frequently, more than 10 or 12 referrals per year. And this is, when we realise this, you can the chart kind of shows you the distribution. The bars show you the distribution of clients. The blue line shows you the distribution of clients, and the bars shows you the food that's distributed. And what you can see is that the clients who are at the top end tend to take quite a proportion of the food, in that 20% of our effort, so if you imagine a five-day week, 20% of our efforts one day a week is spent serving the needs of 4% of our clients. And although there is some kind of need, there are some clients who really don't have anywhere else to turn. The thing that we're really concerned about, and the thing that food banks have to be concerned about, is creating a dependent relationship with the client, so that you don't kind of, by giving food, you don't encourage the client to continually come back and create a dependency. And because it's not good for the client, because they're not addressing necessarily the underlying issues, and it's also not good for the food bank necessarily, because the resources are, you're always consuming more and more resources to meet that dependence. So what we tried to do was we tried to implement a supported client journey. And this is the same, so this is our model since 2017. And the idea is that whilst the client is waiting for their food parcel to be prepared, they can also talk to our support worker. And the support worker can have an open-ended, flexible support, an open-ended conversation with them, and try to address the underlying causes of their immediate crisis. And sometimes it's just simple things. It's just advice on benefits, just signposting, really simple things that people perhaps who are experiencing a crisis for the first time don't know about the system. And so just with a little bit of support, you can help people navigate the system, point people in the right direction. And so this is the model that we adopted subsequent to 2017. And what we found, as you can see from this graph, that what we have on the x-axis here is time going forward, and on the y-axis is the average referrals per client. So you can see from 2017, which is the bottom left-hand corner, up until 2018, when the support service started, the average referrals per client was increasing on a kind of like linear trend. But from 2018 onwards, even though our demand is growing, so we're seeing more clients, the number of referrals per client within that demand has kind of leveled off. And we feel that that is down to the fact that we've implemented this advocacy guidance and support service. So really, it kind of suggests that within the food bank sector, providing support in addition to food is a way of kind of helping people more than just meeting their immediate needs. And we could actually end the story there. Okay, it's all done. But there's some problems in that although it would be really good to offer support to all clients, that isn't possible because not all clients would actually identify, are appropriate for support. Some clients, their issues are well understood and too difficult necessarily for a kind of a simple support intervention. And for the clients who are, we're not going to see very frequently, the clients for whom the crisis is a one-off, the support isn't really required for them. We also only have one support worker and their time is limited and it's better spent supporting clients, actually talking to clients and helping them with their issues rather than trying to identify clients to talk to. And the third issue is that the window of opportunity to engage with the client is quite limited because it's around the time when the client is in the centre waiting for their food parcel. So almost you have to identify the clients before they arrive as being the ones that you would want to talk to and offer support to. So this led us to the question, how do we efficiently identify the clients who would most benefit from our advocacy guidance and support service? And this is where DataKind comes in. So DataKind sponsored this room for the conference today. And just as often happens, we had a kind of serendipitous moment. I received a random email inviting us as an organization to take part in a data dive, which is something that DataKind offer to charities. It gives you access to data scientists and they look at your data and try and draw insights from them. And we got involved in that process, and as a result of that, and through discussions with DataKind, we decided to run a data science project to try and address this question of how we could identify clients who best benefit from a conversation with our support worker. So the project was to build a so-called production-grade model that predicts future client visits and identifies those that would benefit from support. Clearly, we wanted to ensure that it was GDPR compliant with not any kind of socio-demographic bias built into the model. Because we're largely run through volunteers with no IT department, very low levels of IT literacy overall. We had to have something that would run with zero maintenance and at a low cost. We needed to identify some way to retrain the model as situations change so that the model will adapt to circumstances going forward. And we had to try and think of a way that we could integrate the model with our existing information system so that it could access all the client data that it needed to use to make decisions. And clearly we needed buy-in from the Welcome Centre staff to make sure that they wanted to use it when it was finished. So we were able to get some funding for this project from a funder at Esme Fairbairn. They'd also already helped us with our support service by funding a three-year programme for our support worker. And they gave us a small amount of money to allow us to develop this model with DataKind. All the work done on the project was done by volunteer data scientists who were recruited through DataKind and trustees and members of the Welcome Centre who worked on the project as well. And essentially the funding was really just to support the project management and the nuts and bolts of the operation. So how did we go about creating the model? We had a few I would say we had a few kind of enthusiastic moments at the beginning where we were going to solve all the problems in the world, and then we quickly focused in on what we really needed to do to create the model, and we came across a relatively simple approach, which was that we developed a metric to calculate a score that represents each client's usage of our service over the previous 12 months, which is essentially based on the number of times they've been referred to us and the frequency of the referral. We from the earlier piece of work with DataKind, we worked out that a kind of 28-day gap between referrals meant that the client was kind of over one crisis, and the next referral meant it was a new kind of crisis. So we were able to create an actual score for representing a client's referral behaviour in the range 0 to 100, and the idea was we'd get the model to predict what the score would be for the next 12 months without a support intervention. So then we compare the actual score with the predicted score, and where the predicted score was greater than the actual score, that suggests that the client is potentially at risk of becoming more dependent upon our service, and so they would be the clients that the would be recommended to the support worker for a support talk. The model, this is where we get into the technical part. I'm a kind of IT person, but I'm not a data scientist. So it uses something called an extra trees regressor that some people might know, but basically takes a lot of data from our client database system in an anonymized form. Things like, and we found there was nothing in the database that was a real predictor of dependency. There was no single indicator that suggested this is a client that's at risk of dependency. It's really around looking at combinations of indicators rather than one specific thing. So something like the length of time at a particular address seemed to be something that was a good predictor. Dependence, whether the person is single or living with a partner, the number of previous referrals, the reasons for referral, the agencies that have referred the client, all these things form part of the input data to the model to allow it to make the prediction. And I don't know anything about this slide. They're all just kind of weird acronyms to me. This is how the model is implemented. It's using, I do know AWS stands for Amazon Web Services, so it's all implemented in the cloud on Amazon Web Services. It's implemented using a service-oriented architecture, which means from our system, we just call out with a request in that we provide the anonymized data for the client. The model then does its stuff, returns a score, and we can integrate that score within our system. Using AWS was a really brilliant idea because the model is just running in the cloud. All the maintenance is taken care of in terms of keeping the servers running and all that kind of thing. We don't have to worry about that. It's relatively cheap. Based on the number of requests we make, it's about £1.20 a month total cost for the calling out to this model and getting the data back. And there's no local support overhead on our site, so there's nothing for people to worry about, rebooting servers, all that kind of thing. So that's the model technology that we used. And, okay, so how did the model perform? This is a kind of XY scatter chart showing on the X-axis the actual score, and on the y-axis, the predicted score. So where the model, the top left quadrant there, that's where the model suggests that in the next 12 months, the usage for the client is predicted to be higher than it was in the previous 12 months. The ones over in the lower right-hand quadrant, they're where the model suggests kind of a pattern of declining usage going forward. So based on a comparison of these scores, it will be the referrals or the clients making the referrals, which are in this top left-hand quadrant, these were the ones that would be passed forward to the support worker. But this model is only, it's not that the model making the decision, the model is recommending these clients to the support worker as a kind of first cut through, and it's the support worker that makes the actual decision as to whether to have the support conversation with the client. So how did the model perform from anecdotal evidence? Well, probably the biggest kind of bonus, the biggest plus, the biggest positive commendation is that the support worker trusts the recommendations. When the model was first implemented, she would kind of be checking the details of the client and seeing, trying to understand why it was recommending them. But now the support worker trusts what the model is telling her. And also, after 15 months, the model is still being used. The system is an integral part of our business process, and it's not sitting on the shelf gathering dust. I've been involved in a lot of IT projects over my career where I know that you build a system with the best intentions, but after a few weeks or months, it just falls into disuse. People don't want to use it. That's not the case here. And it's not that the model's perfect. It could be improved in some areas. The support worker says that it doesn't really understand universal credit, but that could be down to our need to retrain it perhaps a bit more frequently. So what are the direct impacts of the model on our work within the Wellcome Centre? Well, first of all, it's allowed us to achieve this goal of creating an early intervention model with the clients. So we can get to the clients on either on their first or their second referral to the Wellcome Centre. The clients that we think would benefit from a support conversation, we can identify those clients early and we can talk with them and hopefully give them the advice and guidance that they need to move them, to allow them to address their underlying issues. It's clearly a time saving, there's a time saving benefit from our support for our support worker. She has more time for the direct contact with the clients, less time spent reviewing new client referrals. It reinforces this idea that we have a more effective client engagement model. The provision of the food packs, which was previously our primary business, is now part of a support management plan rather than being based on ad hoc referrals. And the support worker says that when you have a client, when you're working with a client in a supported arrangement, actually the amount of food packs that you give to them is lower than if you just let that client keep referring when they had a crisis. So it really, and that reinforces the graph I showed earlier on, and it really facilitates these new ways of working, going from a purely reactive approach of just giving food when a client arrives to a more proactive way of engaging with the clients. And the wider impacts is that it's allowed us the confidence we've gained through developing this system and through implementing the support service has allowed us to put in a funding bid to expand the support service, to have a second support worker, and we're going to have that backed up by a set of volunteers who will do some triaging and look at some of the more simple kind of signposting support requests. And the ability, with using this method within the model of comparing the actual score with the predicted score, we can adjust the threshold quite easily. So we can generate more client recommendations or fewer client recommendations depending upon the capacity of our support service to deal with them. It's enhanced our strategy to enable this more proactive approach, and we see the support service as being our core function now, not necessarily the food packs, which was what was previously, but the important thing is that the early intervention is vital, and the model allows us to do that. And the other thing that it's done is it's allowed us to change our culture within the organisation, within the Wellcome Centre, at the management and the trustee levels, in that it's allowed us to build our confidence in using data to help our strategic decision making at board level. We've had quite a lot of interest. We had an article published in The Big Issue as a result of this. I did a talk at the Superhighways at the end of 2018. That created a video which has had quite a few views on YouTube. We've had a couple of other articles written, and last year we were nominated for a Data Science Award in the Best Use of Data to Achieve Social Impact category. So it's been, although it's just something that we within the Wellcome Centre just use, within the data science community, it seems to have generated quite a lot of interest as being a really positive use of a kind of data science approach. And so finally, why did the project succeed? So there's a few reasons why the project succeeded, I think. But the main one is that we already had a well-defined business process. We already knew, or we already had a structure through which we deal with clients and an IT system for supporting that process. And I think we got these kind of like basic things right first before trying to implement this kind of higher level functionality. And I think that's kind of, if there was a takeaway from this project, I would say that if you're in an organization and thinking this is a good idea, try to make sure that you have all your basic level things working first before you try to implement something like this. Because if you, as the previous speaker was saying, if you don't have the data there, you can't have a model to utilize that data. So you have to make sure that your basic data collection is reliable and consistent. And I think the other important thing to say is that everybody within the Wellcome Centre, from the staff, the volunteers and the trustees, were invested in the project, and it was a real team approach in terms of developing the solution, which and the data scientists from DataKind worked quite intensively with our support worker in terms of defining the kind of interface and the approach that would work best for her. And I think that was really important as well. It wasn't something that was just imposed on us. It was a collaborative project that we were involved in. And I think, so it sounds like that we're a really clever organization and we've done a lot of good things, but this is our information system in 2014. So 6 years ago, our data science consisted of a box of cards with one card for each client that we had basic details on. And within that card index, there was a lot of inconsistent reporting, a lot of double counting, too much free text. And if we wanted to produce any management reporting, it was difficult. And at some point, 20% of staff time was just spent kind of transposing figures from one list to another. So the reason for this is just to kind of give you some kind of inspiration that even from a low base, you can kind of integrate data science if you kind of like do it as a stepwise approach. I think that's probably where I'll finish and we can have the questions now. Thank you.
So just 2 minutes. Okay. Amazing stuff. Thank you very much, Andrew. Do we have any questions? If you'd like to come forward to one of the microphones, please, just for the closed caption so we can hear you.
I was just wondering what sort of data you had to collect to start the whole process with the data analysts and how you did that, because obviously we've seen this, but then what sort of spreadsheets and stuff?
Yeah, so in 2014, when we realised our demand was increasing and we realised we couldn't continue with the client, the card index system, we looked around to see if there was a kind of food bank database system on the in the public domain, and there didn't seem to be anything that was suitable. So we actually developed our own kind of client database system. We basically record two sets of data, really. We record some information about the clients, and we record information about the referrals, and there's a one-to-many relationship between those. But I think the thing that we worked on was to try to ensure that rather than having free text fields, we used kind of drop downs so we could categorize things more easily. What we found at the beginning was that in a list, say, of referral organizations, the same referral organization was recorded in three different ways, for example. So we weeded out all those kind of things. and, you know, just getting the basics right to begin with. I'm not going to lie to you that actually having the client database was the kind of the foundations for this, because it provided the data for the data scientists to work on. Without the database, we wouldn't have been able to have done it, really.
Thank you for a really, really interesting and focused presentation. You've obviously got a great example of how you've used AI in, you know, to do a really specific task, which is the best way to do it. I just wonder, has this whetted your appetite for it? Have you got more plans, or are you thinking, we've done that, now we're going to, you know?
Well, I think we want to do a kind of stage two, because at the time when we started this project, we only had the information about the referral, so the information about when the clients visited us. We didn't have any information about how effective the support was. So since then, we've been recording the support interventions in the database as well. So it would be really nice to have a kind of version two of the model that closes the loop, and it almost potentially can retrain itself then, in looking at the support and looking at what support interventions mean in terms of future referral patterns. So yeah, that would be our kind of next step, really, I think.
Do you think it's something that could be easily scaled up? So, you know, I suppose to what degree is Wellcome Foundation has its own way of doing things compared to other food banks? So I work for Citizens Advice. Something like this could be fantastic in really being able to target what we're doing in a world where the demand's just well over what we can possibly deal with.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's two points there. I mean, first of all, just around food banks. Food banks all operate in different ways. So they don't all operate on a referral model like we do. Many food banks operate on a kind of drop-in model where the clients come. And typically, food banks are quite resistant to thinking about recording information, because they feel that if they're recording information, there's a kind of association that it's a kind of a way of working out a kind of rationing approach, or that, you know, you're monitoring, it's a big brother type of thing. So philosophically, a lot of food banks, because we thought that our database would be something that other food banks could use as well. But we've tried to kind of like get people interested in it, and we just get the feedback that we don't want to record all this information. We don't think that we should be recording information about our clients. So there's that kind of barrier to get over, and that's probably extends across other voluntary sectors as well, not just food banks. It's certainly the case, though, that this type of approach, using the decision trees and the clustered analysis, this could work in all types of field. But I think the key thing is that you have to have the robust data to underlie it to feed into the model.
Just use the mic again.
Okay. I'm really interested in the behavioural stuff. How did you work out what behaviours were best to look at?
Sorry, what behaviours?
Yeah, when you had to work out what behaviours of your service users and to then plot everything. How did you go sort of brainstorm that?
Well, I think it was based on some earlier work that we did when we got involved in the data dive. We kind of created a traffic light system to begin with. So we partitioned clients into green clients that were low use, then kind of amber, medium use, and red, high use. And the thing that we identified was that we saw that clients seemed to have a kind of like a series of crises, that there would be a crisis, they'd come to us and there would be a burst of referrals, and then there would be a period of inactivity where we didn't see them. That could go on for a year or 18 months or longer. And then there would be another burst. And I think that kind of insight, that helped us then in terms of developing the scoring. That's why we have that 28-day threshold within there. But really, the way the decision tree model works, it's artificial intelligence as such, but it really is very blind. You know, the model can't explain why it's recommended this client. It's just that based on all the inputs, there's a statistical probability that this would be the predicted future behaviour.
That's everything then. Please join me in thanking Andrew once again. Thanks very much. Great story, one I'm really, really fond of.